Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Elizabeth Sando, who already joined us four times on episodes 18, 61, 83, and 99, sharing her truly deep insight into Japanese food culture. And Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan since 1966. So she runs a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And Elizabeth is also the author of six cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen. And today's topic is Sashi Suseso. If you have ever tried to study Japanese, it's the third column of the Japanese hiragana character chart. And the Sashi Suseso also means the essential condiments and seasonings of Japanese cuisine. So today we'll discuss what the culinary sashi suseso is, and details of each condiment and seasonings, how you use them in the right order, and much, much more. But before quickly we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review on iTunes and Stitcher. We appreciate your feedback. And also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. So now let's start our conversation with Elizabeth Sando. So welcome back, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, we've talked about Japanese food culture, but we've never talked intensely about these condiments and other important elements. Right. So, first, I think there is an important term to describe all those important flavoring elements. So that's chomidyo.
Right.
What is chomidyo?
Well, I find it's very interesting. Chomidyo is usually talked about as being seasonings. But when you talk about it in English as seasonings, it sounds like it's something that you add that might not originally be there. And the Japanese word chomidyo, the cho is really accommodation. It's taking something and perhaps improving upon it, and changing it in some way. But essentially, you're not making it different. You're making it better. Mm. And these are things that are going to make the food better because of them. Mm. It's not going to really change the nature of the food.
Right.
And somehow the word seasoning or condiment implies that you've got a separate flavor and you're adding it.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. So, 조미, 조 means, 토토노리 means adjusting. So, it's kind of layering flavors.
Yes, and it's taking the essential essence of the food and it's enhancing it. It's making it better, but it's not really changing it essentially.
Right. So, the point is the idea of Japanese seasonings and condiments, it's more of, more than addition.
Yeah.
Right. So let's go into sashisuseso, which is the essential five elements of chomiryo. Right. So what is sashisuseso?
Well, as you said, anybody who attempts to learn to read and write Japanese learns a, i, u, e, o, kaki, ku, ke, ko, and then comes sashisuseso. And it describes the order in which certain elements are added. And what I think is interesting is that three of them are pretty much universal: salt, sugar, vinegar. Mm-hmm. And almost every cuisine uses those three to enhance or improve or accommodate the flavors. Perhaps.
Right. So the sugar, salt, vinegar. So sugar is sa. And
sa,
the salt
right.
is
she.
And the vinegar is su.
Su.
So, sashi, su, su. The first three.
And I think that they exist in pretty much every cuisine and are important in every cuisine, but I don't know of any other food culture where the order in which you add them, the timing, is so specified. And the Japanese are very specific about the sugar has to come first, the salt will be later, and if you're using anything with vinegar or acid, that's going to be after that. And it's in order to get the most benefit of those elements in terms of accommodating and improving those flavors. So if you add sugar first and wait on the salt, you can get away with less sugar, less salt, and still get better flavor.
Right. So the salt, sugar, salt, vinegar.
Right.
And the fourth one is shoyu.
Right.
But then it's used to be spelled as seiyu.
Right.
So that says se. And then last one, miso. They just happen to...
The so of miso.
Right. So convenience. So if you just forget the order, which one? They say sashisuseso always reminds you.
Right. Yeah. I often will suggest to people that they think of sweet things coming first and salty things later. I think that's probably the most important thing to remember, especially if you're making cuisines other than Japanese. Because these sashisuseso works for any cooking.
Right.
It really has the same benefit.
Well, I heard it's scientifically, it's not my explanation, not so scientific, but I heard the sugar is not easily absorbed into food, so it's better to use it earlier in cooking so that it takes more time to, you know, to allow more time to be absorbed.
It does. And it's also a softener. It often helps to tenderize food as well.
Right. So it's better to use it earlier.
Right.
And I heard that the sugar is hydrophilic, so that it can reduce or retain water in ingredients. Right. And as a result, sugar can soften meat, and sugar permeates into tissues of meat and attract water in meat and connects with the collagen in meat. So that's how I heard it works.
Okay. It works. It really does. And I think that experientially, anybody who tries it and adds sugar, sweet things first and holds off on salty things, whether it be salt or soy sauce or miso, will find that they're able to get much deeper, richer, rounder flavor, and also with less of that substance, less sugar, less salt, less soy sauce, less miso.
Right. So in that order.
Right.
Right. So, and also that salt, you know, the reason we use salt after sugar, the salt draws out water from ingredients. So it's better to use it when it determines the balance of flavors. It's things that has to be drawn out. It's drawn out after salt.
Right.
So
Salt is the first thing usually that's done in terms of any kind of tsukemono, any kind of pickle. Mm-hmm. It creates a brine depending upon what the salt is being rubbed into or sprinkled on. Mm-hmm. The amount of liquid is going to be different, but it does produce liquid. It draws liquid out of the food mm-hmm. that it's come in contact with.
Right. And I think the vinegar goes in the middle because the acidity can evaporate pretty easily. So, and also, I think the, of course, miso is such a delicate flavor. So you don't cook miso. Like when you cook miso soup, never boil it. You just add.
Right. Miso is really, I always think of it as everybody has to be at the table ready to eat. And that's when you add the miso to mm-hmm. soup.
Right. And then, yeah, my mother used to get upset when I boil miso. Like, no, don't do that.
Right. There are a few sauces made with miso where you actually cook them, things like neri miso, where mm-hmm. you're stirring in other flavors.
Right.
But there you're mixing them with other foods, mm-hmm. and so the flavor isn't compromised.
Right.
And those sauces are rarely thought of as adding significant nutrition to the food, whereas mm. the nutrition of the miso in miso soup is important.
Right.
And heat will compromise that, will reduce the amount of mm-hmm. nutritional value. But in a sauce, you're consuming just a little bit.
Right.
And it's primarily for flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are cooking miso in a sauce, it's usually with other things as
right.
well.
Yeah. So we'll talk about miso more into a little more details
okay.
later. But I think you're right that miso just such a rich in protein and so much of, you know, the right. health food.
Yes.
So, okay. And I think it's interesting, Japanese food tend to use sugar in savory dishes.
Yes.
Right? Why is that? I don't know.
I think primarily for balance, especially when you consider that the other two flavors, salty things and sour things, are often overwhelming. And if you add just a little bit of sugar, there are a lot of things that have sort of a sweet and sour.
Mm.
And then something like the teriyaki flavor, which is sugar that's been added to soy sauce, it makes it more mellow. And again, you can get away with less of each, less sugar, less soy sauce, if you combine them in the right order, in the right proportion, and you get maximum flavor.
Right. So I think there's a phrase, gomi goshoku goho,
right.
which is a basic term for Japanese cuisine. So gomi means five tastes,
right.
and sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and acidic.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's
spicy.
That's spicy.
Spicy is the traditional way of thinking about it. And in terms of balancing, there's often sweet is combined with other things.
Mm.
It's the sweet is rarely just a sugary flavor. It's usually added to others. But also appearance, because it adds a sort of a glossy, shiny look, and sometimes food is more appetizing if it has that glossy look to it.
Mm. It's a caramelized,
and
also like Maillard,
right?
Effect,
yeah.
Right? So, yeah. So, so the sugar in food is a sukiyaki and teriyaki sauce,
right? But even like in omelets, with eggs that are primarily savory in taste, but there's a little bit of sugar added to it. For many years, I led a sort of a double life, Tokyo and Osaka, and I was always surprised at certain very basic different approaches, and one of them was about the rolled omelet and the difference between dashi maki, which down in the Kansai area, down in Osaka and Kyoto, was a much milder flavor and no effect of a caramelization at all. You didn't want your egg to pick up any color at all. And in Tokyo, where you had this sort of very rich, almost caramel-like flavor to to the egg, and how they could both be called the same thing, tamagoyaki, sort
That's
of surprised me.
That is really true. Right. And I think, you know, I grew up in Tokyo, and I'm used to that sweet kind of omelet. But right. there's a contrast between saltiness and sugar. That really makes the taste, to me,
right.
very attractive.
And the reverse is also true, because the Japanese put salt on things mm. that are sweet to make them sweeter, like watermelon.
So this talk is actually, that's a, the salt is diverse.
Yes.
Right. So let's talk about it. So that's a kakushijyo, right?
Right.
So kakushijyo, the hidden salt, means to, by just sneaking a little bit of salt, you right. enhance other flavors.
The time that I was most surprised was when I first learned how to make the tsubu-an, the beans, the sweet bean sort of fudge that's often in the middle of sweets, Japanese sweets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made with a lot of sugar, and it's cooked for a very long time. And at the very end, a drop of soy sauce. And mm. it makes all the difference in the world. All of a sudden, mm. what had tasted just like sweet beans tasted like an. It was an amazing transformation, and just a drop, and at the very, very end.
Mm.
And I had never thought to put salt on melon before. I mean, mm-hmm. to me, that was something new coming to Japan. And I would see people put salt on top of watermelon, and I'd look at it very strangely, and I tasted it, and wow, it really does taste sweeter because of the little bit of salt that was added to
right.
it.
Right, and contrast. And also, yeah. I think soy or salt can be, I mean, diversified. You mentioned that just adding soy to azuki beans.
Right.
So that soy has a lot of umami too.
Yes.
So it's a the contrast and right. diversity yeah. that makes
but,
it interesting.
But very much a hidden flavor. I mean, had you asked me whether there was salt in the sweet bean fudge, I wouldn't have thought there was any at all.
Right. Okay. And so what other salt tricks in Japanese have?
appearance is always important in at the Japanese table. And very often there's kesho, sort of like putting makeup on. Mm. It's a sort of this cosmetic effect. And you can eat it. It would be pretty salty.
Right.
But typically with small whole fish that are broiled, the fins are given extra salt
mm-hmm.
and they sort of stand up. It's almost like hairspray being sprayed. It's that stiff sort of look
right.
to it. And it just looks better.
Mm-hmm.
It turns a wonderful sort of a crusty
right.
Salt on it.
Yeah, so if you go to, you know, kaiseki restaurant, there's a fish course, like a little whole fish.
Right.
And that on tail, there's like a bigger chunks of salt sprinkled
right.
over it. And then I think also it's a trick to not to burn that thin tail. So you can have it as a snack, like crunchy snack, but also it's not burned. So
right.
So that's kishoshio.
Right. One of the other things that is often done is salt is combined with other herbs and spices and then used as a dip where you would sprinkle it on top. Sometimes tempura, or I would say probably more often tempura, is served with a sort of a liquid, a soy and dashi-based dip sauce. But I personally prefer it when flavored salt is offered. And in the springtime, sakura jio is added to it. And it's a wonderful floral, really does taste and smell like cherry blossoms.
And it's likely to be pink, maybe?
And pink. It looks pretty and it tastes wonderful. When you take salted cherry blossoms, salt-preserved, cured cherry blossoms, and you buy them, there's a lot of salt clinging to them.
Right.
And if you just shake that off before you use the cherry blossoms and use that as a finishing salt, for cooking, it's quite wonderful. The other flavor that I really like is sancho pepper. And sancho pepper and salt mixed together and used is quite wonderful, just sprinkled on things. Or what else? Matcha is often used with salt, especially at tempura restaurants. It looks pretty.
Right. And also the other day I had the pulverized yuzu
right.
peel.
Wow, that must be wonderful.
I think you can actually use it by yourself, make it by yourself.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Maybe with the coffee brinder, the dried yuzu skins, like lemon skin even.
Yes, and once I had done it with orange peels and mikan, chimpi, the dried mikan peels.
Because that's thinner, easier to
It's much process. Easier to sort of pulverize and make into that. But quite wonderful as a finishing flavor on other things. And then, of course, salt is critically important for all tsukemono. Sometimes it's a very simple shiozuke. It's just a brine, and you're drawing the liquid out of the vegetable and allowing it to ferment, varying degrees of ferment in that brine. And sometimes it's the first thing that you do, and then there are other processes that follow afterwards.
Right. So that was episode 83. You extensively talked about tsukemono pickles.
Tsukemono, right.
Okay, and now, well, speaking with tsukemono, that other way is vinegar. So, and in Japan, the default vinegar is rice vinegar. So how do you describe the flavor profile of rice vinegar?
I would say it's mellow, and especially compared to fruit-based vinegars. Most of the vinegar that's used in Japan is based on grain, and the primary grain is going to be rice. There are some that have also wheat and barley added to them. There are a few fruit-based vinegars. Umezu, which is the natural result of pickling plums. Kaki, persimmon, is also made into soup.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's an interesting ferment, a very different kind of flavor from that. But it's a much rounder, more gentle flavor, I think. And it doesn't, again, interfere with the food that it's being used with. I think that's pretty much a characteristic of all of the chomidyo, all of the seasonings that are used in Japanese cooking, that they enhance, but they don't mask, they don't cover or change anything. They're taking what's already there and making it better. And I think that that's particularly true of the vinegar. It doesn't have a very... it's not as strong, it's not as assertive as perhaps some of the other vinegars that you would find.
Well, because the other day I ran out of apple cider vinegar, which I use on salad.
Right.
And then I used the Japanese rice vinegar. It was very, very much rounded, like you said.
Right.
And I was thinking, this is similar to, pair wine with food versus pair sake with food.
Right.
And sake is very forgiving because it's not so... distinctive in a way, in a good way. So if you need a very strong flavor, maybe, acidic, white wine or just a very tannic red wine, that'd be great. But if you have sake, it's kind of, you can go either direction.
Right. So one of the stronger vinegars that I like that's based on rice, but it's kasu. So it's the leftovers, the lees from making sake, and that's been allowed to ferment. And it's sweet, almost like balsamic. So I think of it as the Japanese version of balsamic vinegar.
I've never tried it.
Really? Oh, it's wonderful. Sanninzu. It takes 3 years to produce. And it's quite dark. So if you mix it with soy sauce, it's not a problem. If you tried to use it on other foods, it would sort of stain it and wouldn't be very pretty looking. But if you're using soy sauce or anything that were a dark color, wouldn't be a problem. It's quite wonderful.
Wow, I have to look for it.
Okay. I know what to bring as my next omiyage for
you. Okay, that would be great. Okay, so there's so many ways to use Japanese rice vinegar in cooking. And the pickles are very common, what you do, of course. But there are many different types of flavored vinegar to make.
Right.
Use it for cooking. So, first of all, what is ponzu? That's very typical.
Well, there are several different stories or legends that are associated with it. But when you look it up in a Japanese food dictionary, it will tell you that the Dutch word ponzu meant a citrus. And so it's likely that the Dutch had used that word and the combination of the vinegar with other foods, particularly with soy sauce, which was already in Japan.
Mm.
And the sound of it was similar to su from su, so it became ponzu.
Mm.
That particular version of the story makes the most sense to
right.
me. So ponzu is essentially any kind of citrus that's mixed with soy sauce.
Mm, so it can be, of course, yuzu, sudachi, kabosu, or lemon,
right.
or orange.
And when I'm not in Japan and I can't find kabosu or sudachi, which are I love because they're very juicy. Yuzu, the skin is more flavorful, but the juice itself can be rather bitter.
Right.
I often will do a combination of grapefruit juice, orange juice, and lime juice. So the three mixed together, I think, are very similar to kabosu,
okay.
which is a wonderful flavor to add.
Mm. So it's the vinegar and the citrus that you like. And some soy sauce.
And soy sauce.
Right.
And then whether you add dashi to it or not, whether you're thinning it out, the proportions of them change a great deal depending upon what you're using the ponzu with.
Mm.
If you're using it just as a dip for something like yakiniku, some you know, pan-seared meat or fish or something of that sort, probably it's going to be one and one, so one part soy sauce, one part citrus, and it'll be pretty strong. But if you're going to be using it more like salad dressing and tossing it with other things, probably dashi will be added to it, and there might be more citrus than soy.
Right. Okay, so you can play with
you can play with it,
right? Vinegar and citrus and soy,
right?
Balancing.
One of my sort of favorite flavors, if you will, is tosazu.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
by the way, the listeners, if you're interested in having ponzu, it's the supermarket. There's so many ponzu.
Yes.
And it's very common. I mean, every single house almost has ponzu in the fridge. So,
yeah, it's a very common and I think very appealing. And one of the reasons why it so quickly became available was because it's so appealing and it's so amenable to other foods, so not just Japanese food. It's a very comfortable flavor to use in a lot of cooking.
Right, a regular salad, American-style salad, even
absolutely.
Like tuna salad.
Right.
Okay, so that's ponzu, listeners.
Right, right.
Right. So you said you're going to cook about tosazu.
So tosazu is probably in the other direction and it might be a little challenging because it has a sort of a funky flavor to it, and that comes from the smoky katsuobushi that's been added to it.
So bonito.
The bonito flakes.
Bonito
and Tosa is a place in on the island of Shikoku that's on the Pacific side, not on the inland seaside of Shikoku, and where a great deal of the bonito fish are caught and processed.
And that's the place you first landed.
Close by.
Right, but the Shikoku.
Shikoku, right. So I'm certainly familiar with that. But if you like smoke, I often call katsuo the sort of bacon of the sea. If you like that sort of smoky flavor, you'll love tosazu. If you have trouble with sort of fishy, funky flavors, it might not become your immediate best friend. But I think it's a fabulous dressing to use, certainly on seafood or on salads where seafood would be a welcome addition.
Right.
And many people who come to my programs, and I do tastings along with the program so they can compare different vinegars, say that they pair it with cheese and that they find that the smokiness sort of cuts through the oiliness of some of the oilier cheeses.
Now, not to mention, you know, bonito flakes have a lot of umami.
Yes.
And the umami of cheese and the umami in the bonito multiplies and adds more flavor.
Right, right. So tosazu is also, it's commercially available, but if you wanted to make your own, what you would do is just put a few katsuobushi flakes in a jar, pour vinegar on top of it, and just wait.
Mm. How long?
Probably 8 to 10 hours, and it's better not to apply heat for it to be a natural infusion of the flavor. Rather than use the very thin flakes, if you can get the thicker flakes, the atsukezuri flakes, in the old days when many households would get their bonito as a whole filet and they would actually slice the very thin slices. I hold my fingers as I say that because that blade is very sharp and very dangerous. because fingers are more important than food, there would always be a chunk left over at the end because you could go just so far in making your own flakes. And nothing goes to waste. And so they were often set aside and used to season other things, either soy sauce or vinegar. And so if you put katsuobushi in the bottom of either soy sauce or vinegar, you'll get a smoky, funky soy sauce or vinegar.
Right.
And it's better not to do it by heat.
Right. Mm. Okay, so we wake up in the morning for dinner, you put the salt, the vinegar, and then...
It could just stay in there...
For days. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and the next one is nihaizu.
Right. Well, this has more to do with proportion. And it's basically equal quantities of vinegar and soy sauce. And the kind of soy sauce you use, the kind of vinegar you use, you're going to get various different flavors, but it's equal proportions. So, ippai plus ippai is nihai. And so that's the origin of the name of nihaizu.
Okay. Right. So soy and vinegar, one to one. Right.
Whereas sambaizu, where you've got a third thing, the third thing is mirin, which is the sweeter sake. And it's when you do want some kind of sweetness added to the sauce. So whether you were using nihaizu or sambaizu would really depend upon whether you wanted to introduce any sweet element or not.
Right. So it can be one vinegar, one soy, and one sugar or mirin, which we're going to talk about a little later.
Right.
But yeah, that's easy. And you can use it for any pickles? Or
all sorts of things. And also, we've got to talk about the different kinds of soy sauce, because one kind has very little color but a lot of salty flavor, and the other has a very dark color and is actually milder. And depending upon what you're combining it with, you either do or don't want the color. So you don't want to stain your food. That's the way the people down in Kyoto talk about it.
Okay, so let's take a quick break in, and then we'll continue conversation when you come back about that color of soy sauce and flavors and the mirin. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
So welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, a food writer and cookbook author and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So so we've been talking about different condiments, and then we almost started to talk about soy sauce, which is a whole other new world. So the sound of shoyu, seoyu, now the sashi, seso, the fourth... Number four of the condiments or seasonings. So, what types of soy sauce are commonly used in Japan?
So, what most people refer to as regular, ordinary soy sauce is rather dark in color. It is salty, but it's made with wheat and soybeans and salt. and allowed to ferment, and depending upon either the artisan who's making it or the commercial company who's making it, the proportions might change slightly, but you get a fairly round flavor, but a very dark color.
Right. And so that's the one, you know, even the supermarkets in the States, they have Kikkoman. That's right. This type. And I heard it's the whole production in Japan. It's 80% of production. That's this type. And then it's called the Koikuchi.
Koikuchi. In Japanese, Koikuchi, as opposed to Usukuchi, which is this sort of lighter one. But usually when you look at the labels in English, it'll merely say soy sauce. Mm-hmm. It won't have any other description. So it's sort of the default, or unless you specify that it's not that, that's what soy sauce is, is that darker color.
Right.
And less intense flavor.
It's really versatile. You can use it for cooking or for sashimi or anything, basically.
Right.
And you mentioned usukuchi, right, as opposed to koikuchi.
Right.
Koi means thick and usu means thin.
Thin. Mm. The problem is that it's often referred to as light, and many labels in America spell light, L-I-T-E, meaning that somehow it's less of something. And actually, usukuchi or L-I-G-H-T colored soy sauce, light colored soy sauce, actually has a higher sodium content.
Mm.
So it's much saltier in flavor, but very pale in color. What it is primarily used for is to not color the food, but imbue it with the flavor of soy sauce.
Right. So it's really common in Kyoto and Kaiseki cuisine because they really emphasize on colors, different seasonal colors.
They're not wanting to change the color of the food.
Mm. So again, it's kind of tricky because color is light, but it's saltier. So you have to use carefully.
You have to use carefully, and it's usually paired with mirin, which is the sweeter sake, and or sugar. And again, we talked about, you know, using sugar in savory things. This is certainly one of the instances where you need it to balance the saltiness of the usukuchi shoyu.
Right. Yeah. So what about the tamari shoyu?
So that's another interesting thing. I'm not quite sure why in America it means wheat-free.
But, really?
Yeah, but most people who come into my programs think that tamari means wheat-free. And I have to remind them, especially if they have a gluten problem, that that's not the meaning of the word.
Right.
Tamaru is to sort of fill up. And I would describe tamari shoyu as being good for dips and finishing flavors, but not for cooking.
Mm.
It's usually too rich and too overbearing to use when you're doing simmered foods.
Right.
So tamari in Japan is made with wheat, and it usually is the richer, thicker, more aromatic.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to cook it. You would want to use it as it is.
Right. So sashimi or sushi.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I think you go to sushi place, you get tamari very often.
Right.
Right. But I heard that, you know, like every reason people say gluten-free.
Right.
Is that the regular koikuchi shoyu that we talked about already.
Right.
It's soybeans, one, to wheat, one.
Right.
And for the tamari, 80% soybeans.
Right.
And wheat, 20%. So it's less, but it's not
wheat-free. But it's not wheat-free. And although most tamari sold here in America is wheat-free.
How interesting.
It is. But it's certainly that's not the meaning of the word. And for people who are traveling to Japan and who do have a problem with
That means that they
gluten.
Make 100% soybeans? Can you make tamari out of it? This is a mystery.
Apparently. I'm not quite sure either how it gets done, but because the wheat is really what gives the aroma to it. But tamari definitely has a sharper deeper flavor. And again, applying heat kills that wonderful aroma. So we don't want, you don't want to use it with heat. Mm. You want to use it only as a finishing flavor.
Right. Okay. And well, there's so many other soy sauce, but we'll save it for the next time, maybe.
Okay.
So the next one, the last one of sashiseso, it's a miso.
Right.
So what kind of variations does miso have?
A million. The Japanese will tend to categorize miso in two very different ways. One is by color, and then it's two. It's either red or it's white. And the red, aka miso, is really brown. Mm. And the white, shiro miso, is really yellow or beige. And I often like it when I do a miso tasting. It looks almost like a hair color chart. Mm-hmm. It goes from blonde all the way through to brunette.
Mm.
But another way of categorizing, not by color, but rather by other ingredients that have been added in the fermentation process.
Mm-hmm.
So if only soybeans are used, it's mame miso.
Mm.
And it's actually pretty few compared. Most of the miso in Japan is not just bean.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the miso in Japan is rice enriched, so it's kome miso.
Right, so the soybeans and rice and salt.
Then the third element that adds a very distinctive flavor is barley, so mugi miso.
I love the mugi miso flavor.
I love mugi miso also.
It's kind of like a nadia.
It's a very yeasty, it's very interesting. People who really like yeasty breads also love mugi miso.
Right.
And the texture is quite wonderful as well. So probably miso originated in the mainland China, came into Japan through the Korean Peninsula, and probably entered Japan in and around Nagoya. And that's the area in Japan that still primarily eats mame miso. Hachō miso is very thick, fudge-like, and is only made of soybeans.
Mm.
And it has a somewhat of a hoisin sauce-like flavor to it. You can sort of tell that it had Chinese origins, I think, to it.
Interesting.
Most of Japan eventually added rice, different types of rice, different proportions of rice in the making of miso.
Mm.
And kome miso is overwhelmingly, I think it's almost 70% of the miso produced in Japan is kome miso type. But not all kome miso is similar in flavor. There's a lot of regional difference with that. But in terms of categorizing, it's either by color or it's by how it's been enriched in the process of being made.
Right. Yeah, I heard that when the Harold Mackey came to our show,
which
is a food scientist, and then he said the color of miso can tell to some extent how rich the flavor is. The darker, the richer, because the color thickens, gets darker over time because it's a Maillard reaction.
Uh-huh.
So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the amino acid and the sugar over time just react and they get combined in a way.
Right.
So, and I wanted to eat more because of the flavor.
But one of the things that I would caution people again is that the lighter color doesn't necessarily mean it's less salty. And when I do my miso tasting, one of the things that I include is Nihonkai miso, which is very pale in color and extremely salty. It comes from Akita Prefecture. Extremely salty. Right.
Well, I think, the northern part of Japan, Akita is very north, and then they have to preserve things. They tend to have saltier food, so maybe their palate.
Yes. Right. So the color isn't always, the light-colored miso doesn't always mean it's going to be sweet-tasting. But very definitely the length of time required to ferment it is less. So the lighter the color, probably the less. And many of the saikyo miso from Kyoto is only a few months.
Okay.
At most.
Right.
actually six to eight weeks, I would say, is the time for most of the saikyo miso,
right,
from start to end, whereas hacho could take 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So interesting. So that's another aging stage you may want to take
a look
another, at.
Yes, it's very much, it's a more mature. Mm. The darker the color, the more mature the flavor is also going to be.
Right, maybe more umami, you can say also.
I think so.
Right. Mm. Yeah, but it's nice to have, you know, people like umami, but I like mixing different miso. Or sometimes rice, and I like saikyo because of the sweetness of saikyo.
Right. So awase miso, I think, is a common practice.
Mm-hmm. Meaning combining miso.
Different kinds of miso, blending, mm-hmm, and different kinds is very common practice.
That's awase miso.
Right. And many households will do it by the weather or the temperature or the season.
Mm.
And in the summer, it would tend to be saltier, the proportion of saltier miso would be greater, and in the winter, sweeter would be greater.
Mm.
And I guess it makes sort of sense. You sweat more in the summer, and you crave more salty foods. Not all households will make those adjustments, but many will. So the same miso soup that they would enjoy in the winter might have a bit heavier proportion of a sweeter miso and less of a saltier one, whereas in the summertime it would be the reverse. Also, I think there are certain ingredients certainly in miso soup that benefit from certain flavors of miso.
Right.
Mushrooms and root veggies and it's
interesting, right, that the miso is so regional. Like, for instance, if you go to the south, like Shikoku, right, Kyushu, you have more barley. That goes well with the local food as well.
Yes, so, very much so.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and so now, it's not including the sashi seso, but I think the mirin that we mentioned a couple of times is very important to me.
It is.
I mean, in my opinion, I think it plays a lot of roles in Japanese
cooking.
It does. So what is mirin?
So real mirin is sake that's been brewed from mochi gome.
Mm.
So most sake is brewed from uruchimai, which I refer to in English as table rice, meaning it's the rice that you would eat at a meal, mm-hmm, when you're sitting at the table is uruchimai.
Mm.
And almost all sake is made from uruchimai.
Mm.
When the same process is applied to mochi gome, and mochi gome is the rice that gets pounded into making omochi.
Mm. So people call it sweet rice?
It's sweet rice. Mm. Sometimes it used to be mislabeled as glutinous rice. There's no gluten in rice at all. It's sticky. It's sticky, but there's no gluten in it at all.
That's very important.
So it is a sweeter grain.
Mm-hmm.
And just as you can get corn syrup from corn, so you can get a very syrupy flavor. You can get rice malt from rice, but it's going to be from the sweeter rice. So mirin, real true mirin, is sake that's made from mochi gome.
Right. So I think it's basically adding sweet rice or the, you know, the sticky rice.
Right.
And koji mold into shochu.
Right, right.
So that's why it has a higher alcohol level, around 14 or above.
Or above, yes. It starts at 14, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why I think some shops cannot sell mirin because it's not, they don't have a license.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. So that's why they have different kinds of mirin foo. Mirin style.
Yeah. There are certain words that I caution people about when they're shopping for things. Who and means the winds have blown over. It's an approximate flavor. It's always disappointing in my mind. But yes, most of the mirin that is sold is really sake and sugar that has been blended.
Mm.
And I didn't stop to think about the alcohol content, but I guess that's part of it.
Right. Yeah, I think it plays a lot of role because, you know, the alcohol goes deeper into the ingredients.
Yes.
So it brings in more flavors together with alcohol. But that alcohol evaporates when you cook it.
It evaporates and therefore it blends better. It's a smoother blend.
Right.
Food that has been cooked with meeting has a much smoother flavor, I think,
right,
than the foo meeting.
Right.
Your windy meeting.
Right, because I think the mirin has milder sugar flavor, the sweetness.
Yes.
Right, because it's a converted, starch converted to sugar.
Right.
But then it's fermented, so it's more kind of, I think, different kinds of the sugar.
Mm. It produces a rounder flavor and also a much more beautiful gloss and sheen to it. It's not as rough tasting as sugar would be. It doesn't taste like candy. It tastes rounder. It has a much more body to it.
Right. And also, if you want to caramelize a food with sugar, it doesn't get that even, you know, the coating like mirin.
Right. Mirin is also very important in sauces that will be coating other foods.
Mm.
And you're wanting it to be an even distribution. So it seems to blend better with other foods so that it's evenly distributed. You don't get pockets of flavor separating out afterwards.
Right. Yeah. And just like you said, it coats the foods. I heard that the mirin can make foods shape when you simmer it in a pot for longer hours.
Yes.
So that's like a magical condiment.
It is indeed.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's available in the States, I think.
It's hard. You really have to read the labels. And I always get frustrated when they slap labels in English over the original Japanese. Mm. And you can't read the original Japanese on it. Because the FDA, I think, has different rules about what needs to be on that label than the Japanese government. But if you can find real meeting in my own supermarket, there's only a whole shelf, and there's only one that's the real stuff.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
Right. So hopefully listeners can find mirin, and you can just use it for many different kinds, not like, you know, finishing up, but more for cooking and making things shinier and cook and simmer to make.
And I do think that all of these things we've been talking about apply to any cuisine. It's not just when you're cooking Japanese food that you're going to see a difference about sashisuseso. So you should be doing the sugar and thinking about it, adding it to savory flavors, and the salt to also add to sweeten things, but that comes later. I think all of these principles or ideas work well with any kind of cooking.
Right. So listeners, sashisuseso. That's
Sashi
your lesson today.
Yeah, indeed.
Right. Thank you. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
All right, so listeners, if you'd like to know more about Elizabeth's projects and updates, please visit tasteofculture.com. That's one word, tasteofculture.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at Japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan News is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher as a podcast. And today's engineer is David Tatasure, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.